From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. The Women's World Cup soccer tournament in France is just 3 months away. The United States women are again the world's number one team. But all 28 players of the U.S. team have thrown down the gauntlet. They filed 28 separate lawsuits in a California court last week, accusing the U.S. Soccer Federation of discrimination in everything from pay to benefits to safety. Now, this battle has been fought for years in soccer, but in other sports too, such as hockey, tennis, and basketball. This hour on Point, U.S. women's soccer and the push for equity in American sports. And you can join us. The U.S. Soccer Federation says women have got their facts wrong. Well, yeah, right, say the players. So what do you think? Should pay be related to revenues in U.S. soccer? We've seen similar efforts, as I said, in hockey and basketball. So what should equity look like in the highest level of sports in the United States? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, in a couple of minutes, we're going to be speaking with retired star goalkeeper Brianna Scurry about what she thinks about all this. But first, let's go to Lindsay Gibbs. She's a sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the sports podcast Burn It All Down, and she joins us from Washington. Lindsay, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me.
So why don't you first sort of just briefly lay out what the players are alleging in their lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation. What basis of discrimination are they saying exists?
Absolutely. So they are saying this is institutionalized gender discrimination. They filed this on Friday, which was International Women's Day. And as you mentioned, the lawsuit comes from the 28 current members of the United States women's national team. So they're looking for class action status. So the lawsuit is seeking damages, back pay, and an adjustment of the wage rates and benefits for the women. It was filed in the U.S. District Court in Los Angeles under the Equal Pay Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. It says that despite the fact that these female and male players are called upon to perform the same job responsibilities and participate in international competitions, that female players have been consistently paid less money than their male counterparts.
Okay, so let's dig into that a little bit. How much less are they claiming they're getting paid?
So according to the lawsuit, top-tier women's players would make only about 38% of similarly situated men's players.
38%.
Yes. So not great.
Okay. But so we're going to explore this a little bit more later because, you know, there are some people say it's an apples and oranges comparison because also the men and the women have different collective bargaining agreements with the U.S. Soccer Federation. And, you know, that may be part of the problem, that they didn't bargain their way to more equal pay.
Correct. I mean, there is a little bit different of a structure, so it's hard to do a dollar-to-dollar comparison. But what this lawsuit has done is broken down a lot of the different ways in which they are paid. But it's important to know that this isn't just about equal pay. The lawsuit also focuses on playing, training, and travel conditions, promotion of the games, staffing, including coaching, medical personnel, and training, and operations, and other support for the team. So they're looking for equitable support as well.
Okay, so put this in broader context for us, because some folks might remember that a couple of years ago, players filed a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, right? And apparently this lawsuit relieves the investigation that the EEOC might have launched, right? So the lawsuit now is taking center stage. But the top female soccer players in America have had a long battle with the U.S. Soccer Federation over a number of issues. I mean, I'm thinking of the turf battle from a couple of years ago. So what has the relationship been between the two groups for several years now?
It's been incredibly tense and, I would say, at times even hostile between the two groups. And look, this has been going on behind the scenes for decades, really. But it really, like you said, came to a head in 2016 when they filed this wage discrimination complaint with the EEOC. And it was Alex Morgan, Megan Rapinoe, Becky Sauerbrunn, Carly Lloyd, and former U.S. Women's National Team goalkeeper Hope Solo, five of the most recognizable names in U.S. soccer, who filed that complaint.
Well, Lindsay, stand by here for just a second, because I do want to turn to one of the United States' former top players. Brianna Scurry joins us now. She's with us from Clearwater, Florida. She's a two-time Olympic gold medalist, World Cup champion as well. She retired from USA Soccer in 2010 and today is an assistant coach for the Washington Spirit, the Capitals women's team. She was elected to the National Soccer Hall of Fame in 2017, the first woman goalkeeper and first African-American woman to be elected to that Hall of Fame. Brianna Scurry, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. So give us your sense, your personal experience, or what you see. Did you feel the effects of this alleged pay discrimination in your soccer career?
I did, and it's true. We've been waging this battle for many decades, and I think what's important for folks to understand who are looking at this lawsuit currently is one of the main reasons why we've had the battle and why they're bringing this suit, in my opinion, is because the argument that U.S. Soccer has made and a lot of other people make about revenue and all that kind of thing is not necessarily the full picture. Part of the problem, and major problem I feel, is where the dollars go from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. When it comes to sponsorship, like from companies like Nike, when it comes to, you know, seeding, you know, development programs, you know, like the boys has had a development program through U.S. Soccer Federation and for 10 years, and the girls just recently got one in 2017. These are the things that create an issue later on, and the same things that if U.S. Soccer was equal in seeding money for programs, for marketing, for sponsorship, that comes into U.S. Soccer as the governing body of soccer in this country for both boys and girls, men and women,
yeah,
you would have a closer parity in revenues, you know, ticket prices, you know, seats sold and whatnot. And so it's almost like a backward argument that they make when it comes to, well, we're not paying them more because they don't make as much money as the men. Well, my argument is, well, you never put the money in that you should have put in, and they still win.
Okay.
They still win.
Interesting.
Regardless.
I was just going to jump in and say exactly, just sort of reflecting what U.S. Soccer has been saying, that perhaps the implication is, why should they put more money in now at the front end if already the men's game for years has proven to be, not necessarily in the United States, but globally, by far, the bigger revenue generator?
Well, that's a great point. That's a great point. And I understand that. But what we're looking at here is you can't argue against discrimination if initially, in the beginning, you already discriminated.
Mm-hmm.
So how mm-hmm. would we possibly know if the women couldn't be bigger revenue generator had you, as a governing body, mandated to provide equal opportunity for both boys and girls? As it's not a profit organization, it's a nonprofit. It's supposed to govern for both genders, for the entire country, and grow the game of soccer. But categorically, over time, over years, they have purposely, and this lawsuit states it several times in there, policy and practice of discriminating against the women's team.
Yeah. And also, I want to dig into this a little bit, because some of the differences, the dollar differences, seem just kind of flat out bizarre, right? Like there were a couple of years ago, there was a difference in which U.S. Soccer paid the women, I think this was roughly in 2015, 2016, paid the women a $60 day per diem for expenses, and the men got $75. And then the women got $3,000 for sponsorship experiences, and the men got $3,750. I mean, these are differences that seemed kind of petty and didn't make any sense.
Absolutely, and they're everywhere, right? So it's a nickel here, a dime there. They're everywhere, these discrepancies, and they've been going on for a long time. In my generation, when we played, we had to bump it up just to get it even close to where it is now. And that took a lot of fighting. And now, so that's why I think it seems like it is almost like it is a policy and a practice, because it's everywhere you turn, from, you know, the quality of a flight, the quality of a hotel, whether you get, you know, per diem. Mm-hmm. Are they saying that the female athlete doesn't expend as much energy, or the female athlete entertainment, you know, money for entertainment, for taxis, for all this stuff, doesn't deserve to spend, or doesn't allow to have, shouldn't be allowed to have as much money and spend as much money as they give to the men? It's just, it's everywhere you turn.
Yeah.
We're having to fight against these little seemingly incremental small things, but they add up when you add them all together. And that's why you have such a discrepancy. And one other thing I'd like to mention with last Women's World Cup championship team in 2015, you know, the suit mentioned that the men in getting to the round of 16 made $5.3 million, and the women made $1.7 for winning the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the issue, in my opinion, is, in part, the U.S. Soccer Federation's standard of excellence for the women's team has always been to win, not just to show or to place, but to win. And even though that has been the standard for almost 30 years for the women's side, still do not give the women the dollars that they would give the men to win. And the standard is different for the men. Well, but they just want them to qualify and show.
Brianna, can I just jump in?
Expected to win.
Can I just jump in here for a second? Because I want to be clear on something. Now, the example that you just gave from 2015, is that money that's coming from FIFA or USA Soccer?
Well, it's both, right? So part of it is from FIFA and a bonus structure. So that's the other argument, right? That's the other argument. Well, we get the money from FIFA, and we're supposed to earmark it for the. It's only earmarked for men. Well, the sponsorship dollars that U.S. Soccer gets from Nike and whatnot, if Nike said, hey, we want to just give all this money to the women, I don't think that's what would happen.
Yeah. Well, Brianna Scurry, stand by for just a second. And Lindsay Gibbs, hang on here for a moment. We are talking about America's top female soccer players. These are world champions and World Cup champions filing suit alleging gender and pay discrimination against the U.S. Soccer Federation and the long-running battle for equity at the top levels of sports in America. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about America's top women soccer players and the lawsuit they filed against the U.S. Soccer Federation alleging gender and pay discrimination and the long-running battle at the top level of sports in America for equity between men and women. Lindsay Gibbs is with us. She's a sports reporter at Think Progress and a co-host of the sports podcast Burn It All Down. And Brianna Scurry is with us as well, two-time Olympic gold medalist, World Cup champion goalkeeper, elected to the National Soccer Hall of Fame in 2017. And Brianna, I know we've got to let you go here in just a minute, but before we do, would you just permit me to take a brief dribble down memory lane for a moment? Because I just want to play that moment from the 1999 World Cup final, that like insane shootout between the United States and China. And you had this huge save during the penalty shootout. And just here's that moment.
Ying will go next, the first starter for China to take a penalty kick. The shot, save, scoring!
That was such an intense game. I'm still feeling it decades later. I never thought I'd have the chance to talk with you, Brianna. So I just want to ask you, relive that moment. Tell us what it was like. And also, to get back to our bigger conversation here, following that massive victory, did you feel the benefit sort of in terms of all these other issues that you're talking about? Did the U.S. Soccer Federation step up and say, you guys just won the World Cup, we want to help you more?
Oh, wow. Let me tell you what. So that, let's start with the really good stuff, right? So describing that feeling, I was, you know, that team, first of all, is truly one in a million, billion team. I mean, we were just an amazing squad, and each kicker had their job, which was to make their kick, and my job was to save one. And so we really did have everything lined up as a team for each of us to do our jobs and to do them well in such the high-pressure situation that we had. And, of course, we have a flair for the dramatic. But I have to say, that one kicker, normally I don't I do a certain routine. And for that particular kicker, I didn't go with my routine. I actually looked at her, and because something told me that she was going to be the one I was going to save. And so when she came up to the penalty spot, I just knew. And so the anticipation in my heart and in my body was just so, like, just ready to explode. And then, you know, when she kicked it, I can honestly say that people are like, oh, well, you know, you think you would have saved it no matter what. No matter where she kicked it, I feel like I would have saved it. And then just the place just erupted. And my response afterwards is just, you know, I just essentially roared. Joy and excitement, you know, because I knew I'd done my job and I knew that my teammates would do theirs. And so it was just an amazing feeling. And then, of course, Brandy taking the final kick,
yeah,
and taking off her shirt. I mean, that whole moment and all of that 10 minutes, right, of drama is one of the most amazing bits of sport, men or women,
right,
in my opinion, and a lot of people's opinion.
I mean, after you did that save, and as you mentioned, Brandi Chastain taking the winning penalty kick. Honestly, in penalty shootouts, men or women, I can never watch. I, like, watch through my hands because it's so stressful. I cannot imagine what it's like for you standing right at the goal line. But so
that's okay. My mom was the same way. She used to cover her face, too, when she watched me do penalty kicks and then just go based on fan response afterwards. But in response to the second part of your question about the equity piece of this, so that's another interesting element of this. So we, originally, U.S. Soccer actually didn't step up. So what happened was the Women's World Cup Organization Committee, they gave every player a bonus of $50,000 each for winning the World Cup. So that money did not come from U.S. Soccer Federation. And when,
wow.
Then what we did afterwards was we created a victory tour where we took our game to 10 different cities around the country, essentially as, you know, to celebrate with the entire country our amazing victory and for people to meet us. And we brought the World Cup trophy with us and everything. And we played these barnstorming games called the Victory Tour. And we did that all. We organized that. So now that's actually something that they do on a regular
basis, right,
for the team. And that's something that we created after the 99 World Cup completely on our own. And with the Women's World Cup Organizing Committee, and then over time, U.S. Soccer realized that they needed to do something with it, and so they eventually took it in and created and continued to do it after that.
Well, in fact, those victory tours now make millions of dollars for,
yes,
USA Soccer. Well, Brianna Scurry, two-time Olympic gold medalist and World Cup champion as well, elected to the National Soccer Hall of Fame in 2017. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for joining us today.
And you as well. Thank you so much for having me. I greatly appreciate it, and be well.
Well, Lindsay Gibbs, hang on here for just a second, because I want to bring in two more voices into this conversation. First of all, joining us from Dallas, Texas, is Rich Nichols. He's a sports industry lawyer currently representing Hope Solo in her lawsuit against against U.S. Soccer. He was executive director and general counsel of the Women's National Team Players Association. That's the union for the national team. He also spearheaded collective bargaining agreement negotiations in 2015 and 2016. Rich Nichols, welcome to On Point.
Thank you very much. Glad
also,
to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. And also with us from New York is Mike Ozanian. He covers sports and money for Forbes. He's managing editor and co-host of Forbes Sports Money, which airs on the Yes Network. And we have links to his recent columns at onpointradio.org. Mike, welcome to you.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you.
It's great to have you. And Mike, I'd actually like to start with you because obviously thus far in the program, we've been hearing a lot of arguments in favor of changing how the women are paid in U.S. soccer, but you don't necessarily see a problem in the pay differential right now. Why is that?
Well, I'm going to nuance it a little bit, if I will.
Sure.
If I may. The way the collective bargaining agreements are now structured and the way things are set up with FIFA and so forth, clearly the pay structures are set up mostly tied to revenue, and in most years, the men generate far more revenue than the women, and therefore get paid so much more. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm just saying that's the way it is, so therefore the pay gaps are easily explained. men do much better typically on TV ratings as well. I would like to see two major changes as someone who has an only child who's a daughter, who's now 11 and who likes playing soccer, and someone who follows soccer globally on the professional level. I believe that the women need to break away from the U.S. Soccer Federation. I think it's a lethargic, backwards-thinking organization. You have a lot of people collecting money who really don't do anything. I think they have to do something akin to when Billie Jean King started the Women's Tennis Association back in the 70s. Hmm. You mentioned with your previous guest on how they started that Cup Championship Tour. Well, that was their idea. That was not the U.S. Soccer Federation's idea. The players are far more creative, the women's players. They have far more better ideas. I like to see them set up something on their own. I think the revenue enhancements would be great.
Yeah.
The connection to the fans would be much better. And the second thing I'd like
to... Well, if I can just jump in here, Mike, for a second, because you've laid out a bunch of ideas here, and let me turn to Rich Nichols here for his take. And that previous guest you were referring to was Brianna Scurria, World Cup champion.
You.
Yep. Rich Nichols, what do you think? In fact, we actually have another... We have a commenter on our Facebook page, Doug Larson, who says pretty much the same thing. He says the women should just establish their own federation where they have complete control over pay scales, working conditions, and revenue streams entirely independent of the U.S. Soccer Federation.
Well, I'm not going to address that because I think that's just a pie in the sky kind of a thought to abrogate and get away from U.S. soccer's responsibility to pay the women equally. So the first few things I wanted to say is that, you know, to make it clear, you know, Hope Solo filed this lawsuit first in August of last year when she and we got frustrated with the EEOC dragging their feet with a 3-year investigation and basically doing nothing. And Hope decided that, you know what, Rich, let's file this lawsuit now. And get ahead of the game, because it's clear that the EEOC is not going to rule in our favor if they rule at all, and we just need to keep U.S. soccer's feet to the fire. So this lawsuit was filed by Hope Solo first last August, and we really did hope that at some point in time the rest of the team would follow suit. And we did keep their counsel informed with the progress of our suit all the way along the way, including the first hearing that we had a couple of weeks ago in federal court in San Francisco where we filed this suit, where we tried to encourage the judge not to transfer the case from San Francisco or out of California to Chicago, but to send it to L.A. So we're really grateful that the team has finally stepped up and joined us in this fight, but that battle began last summer with Hope. And next, I always hear this notion of pay equity. Well, this isn't a pay equity fight. This is a pay equality fight. You know, equity is about fairness, and U.S. soccer always hides behind this fairness notion, this equity notion that, oh, we're treating the women fairly. We don't want to be treated fairly. We want to be treated equally. It's all about equal pay, equal playing conditions. Equality is what we're fighting for. And this revenue argument is specious. And my colleague from Forbes is wrong on all three fronts. The CBA, both CBAs are not tied to revenues. And the men do not accrue more revenues than the women. The women have historically accrued more revenues than the men. And U.S. Soccer's own financials that they presented us during the collective bargaining negotiations in 2016 reflected that. In fact, they even said that the women are the economic engine of U.S. soccer, and that's true. And the third thing
so
that he's wrong about is TV ratings.
Rich,
let me just finish this point.
No, no, I'm going to get to the TV ratings in a second. But this revenue thing is going to come up again. Yeah, it's going to get. But the revenue thing is going to come up again and again and again. I just want to clarify something. And that is, you know, I think in a way, we're in this conversation, we've inadvertently started mixing sort of FIFA-related World Cup revenues, which the men do make billions of dollars for the host nations, for the World Cups, and revenues for U.S. soccer. And to your point, if I have my facts right, the women do make more revenue for U.S. soccer versus for FIFA in World Cup years. Is that right?
That is correct, and we can't control what FIFA decides to award in bonuses. You know, we'll gladly take what they decide to award in bonuses, but we can't control it. But that being said, based upon the women's national team's push 2 years ago with the EEOC fight for equal pay, FIFA did step up and increase the bonus structure with the World Cup for this year. So the U.S. women, we take great pride in having at least contributed to the increase in FIFA bonuses this year. But with regard to U.S. soccer revenues, the women always accrue more revenues. And the big source of revenues that U.S. Soccer just refuses to disclose is the amount of money that U.S. Soccer accrues from their outside marketing agent called Soccer United Marketing. Some has the right to sell all U.S. Soccer assets, including the men's and the women's team. And we know that they utilize the women's team when they go out into the marketplace to sell television rights and corporate sponsorships. They're certainly not leading with the losing men's team and trying to encourage the corporate America television rights broadcast networks to buy U.S. Soccer based on the men's performance. They're using the women's performance to go out there and sell the team. And we, to this day, we do not know exactly how much revenue accrues from some to U.S. Soccer with regard to the ability for some to sell the women's team. And we've asked for those figures.
Yeah.
We were rebuffed. The U.S. Senate asked U.S. Soccer for those figures. The U.S. Senate was rebuffed. The EEOC told us they asked U.S. Soccer for those figures. They were rebuffed. So the only way to get to the bottom line about these revenues is to file what Hope did last summer and what the women did last Friday, is to file federal lawsuit and get into discovery. And we're going to find out how much revenues, how many revenues come to U.S. Soccer from some.
Okay, Rich, so I promise you we will get to the television ratings issue in just a second here. But Mike, you've been patiently listening here. I just want you to respond that Rich basically says the whole revenue argument is a total canard. What's your response to that?
He has no idea what he's talking about. If you look at the sum of all the revenues that are collected, a lot of what he's talking about depends on how you count money. He himself just admitted he doesn't know how much of the sponsorship revenue is generated. You know, there's a big difference between game day revenue and the revenue in total that, whether it be the networks pay or the sponsors like Nike paid. But in a way, I think he's proving my argument in the sense that he's been asking for information that he hasn't been able to get. If you look at TV ratings, you know, last year in 2018, the average viewership for the men, U.S. soccer, was almost 432,000. The average ratings for the women viewership was 300,000. So, you know, it's hard to sit there and say, well, for these national deals where there are many, many more eyeballs watching the men, that the bulk of the revenue goes to the women.
Okay.
If you go to the World Cup.
Yeah. Hang on here for just a second. Lindsay, I hear you, and I'm going to get your response for sure. But I did promise Rich, since Mike turned us back to the TV ratings issue, I did promise Rich a chance to respond to that. So go ahead, Rich.
Well, I will say that I absolutely know what I'm talking about because I led the negotiation for the CBA, for the collective bargaining agreement for the women a couple of years ago, and I did get a chance to at least look at the revenues that and the financials that U.S. Soccer was willing to provide us, and the financials that they provided us showed that the women accrue more revenues than the men, and in fact, their financial projections going through this year, 2019, continued to show that the women would accrue more revenues than the men. And with regard to the TV ratings, I don't know what ratings you're looking at, but the women at the World Cup final in 2015,
you're looking at
28. I didn't interrupt you. Don't interrupt me. 28 million. Don't interrupt me. 28 million viewers, the most watched soccer game in the history of televised soccer.
Be honest.
Well, you know what, man? I'm not going to address your.
Well, I'm going to jump in here, Mike. And if you're, but why does that one game not matter? I mean, I get it about averages, but on the other hand, I think it was a significant marker for all of American soccer that one game broke records.
Because when people buy an ad or pay for a sponsorship, they're looking at it for across the board. They're not looking at one particular game. You can't say there's no question the women have been better than the men. But when you're looking at the overall viewership numbers for a year, on a yearly basis, the men get many more viewers.
Yeah, so here's the question. We got to take a quick break in a minute. But, Mike, I really would just want to ask you, I mean, are you basically saying that we should be okay with the idea that sports is just merely a product whose only value is measured by revenue? I mean, you just said the women are actually better than the men, but their value is being measured by dollars and cents. I mean, doesn't that fundamentally feel unfair?
No, But I think it can be improved, and that's what I wanted to get into a little bit earlier. And there are two ways to improve it. And the first way is the way that the...
Well, Mike, premier, actually, hang on here, because you hear the music. We got to take a break. And Lindsay, you've been very patient. I promise to come to you as soon as we get out of this break. Mike Ozanian, Rich Nichols, and Lindsay Gibbs, stand by. We are talking about the very passionate conversation around pay equity at the top levels of women's and men's athletics, this time specifically regarding USA Soccer. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Megan Chakrabarty. We're talking about members of the United States women's soccer team, the top female soccer players in the world, actually, right now, and their lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation alleging gender and pay discrimination. Callers, I promise I'm going to get to you in a couple of minutes, but Lindsay Gibbs, you've been very patient here through a great deal of the conversation. There's been a lot we've chewed over. So go ahead. Just give me your quick take on what you've been hearing so far.
Yeah, I just think it's important to say, you know, there's all this talk about revenue and you can pick and choose years or ratings or dates to prove different points, because the truth is this stuff fluctuates a little bit, right? The women in 2015 brought in $4 million more dollars in profit than the men did that year, right? So they're, you know, it's not always exactly equal. I thought the men's National Team Players Association, their response to the Women's National Team Players and this lawsuit was to say that they completely support these efforts and they are actually committed to the concept of a revenue sharing model to address the, quote, market realities that U.S. Soccer Federation always brings up. So they are proposing an equal division of revenue attributable to the Men's National Team and Women's National Team. And they've said that this is something that in their current collective bargaining agreement that they are actually pushing for. So I think that's really important. They're not here sitting on the side saying, we make so much more money and we want to hog all the money. They're saying, look, there's a way to pull all of this that everybody is getting and to make things equal.
Well, Mike Ozanian, I've got to let you go here in a minute or two, but you said you had two quick ideas on sort of how to right the ship here. And I just wanted to give you a chance to let us know what those ideas
are. I'll be real quick. One is I would do a model that not only is based on revenue, but is based on success. Right. And I think that would really help. And the second thing has to start with our schools. And I think that's where women really get shortchanged when it comes to the development, as one of your first guests said. My daughter's in junior high. And the first thing that the BOA, which is always claiming to be proactive about equality and women's rights and all that stuff, the first thing they wanted to do was eliminate two or three of the women's sports in junior high, volleyball, soccer, and I think girls' basketball was the other, to save money for air conditioning. They didn't want to touch any of the men's sports. And I said to him, I said, don't you think there's any hypocrisy here? You're always talking about equality and this and that, and the first thing the BOE wants to do is cut these sports out. Well, these are then ladies that are going to grow up and without playing these sports, in junior high, aren't going to get the support in high school and so forth and aren't going to be there. So we're teaching, I think, the wrong things at a very early age if we believe in men and women should get equal support in sports.
Mm. Well, Mike Ozanian, who covers sports and money for Forbes and managing editor and co-host of Forbes Sports Money, which airs on the Yes Network. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm sorry to have to let you go, but we've got a ton of callers and I do have to make a little space for them. So, Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
It was great to have you. Okay, so Rich Nichols and Lindsay Gibbs, hang on here for a second. Let's go to Carol.
Is it possible for me to respond to a couple of improper facts that were just stated?
I will come back to you, Rich. I promise.
Right.
But there's a kind of balance I have to strike here. I do put out that phone number a lot, and poor callers are waiting on the line for like 40 minutes sometimes. I just want to relieve them of their being like on the edge of their seats here. So Carol is calling from Portland, Maine. Carol, you're on the air.
Hi, Magna. Yeah, thank you very much. Good for the women. Good for the women soccer players. I've been fighting this issue my entire professional career as a coach, but there is a chicken and egg here. Marketing and advertising has to be increased for the women. You open the Boston Globe, and there's nothing. There's just nothing about women. And I think it's most of the papers in this country. And the other is the value system that we have. Why do we value men's sports more than women? And why do women go out and watch men's sports, but they don't come and watch women's sports? I think those are the two issues that really make this argument. Brianna brought it up a little bit, but I think that's important.
Yeah, and I think it's especially important in a game like soccer where you can make a very strong argument that the women may actually play a better game. Carol, thank you so much for your call. Okay, Rich Nichols, you're back up here. I know there's a few things that you wanted to respond to, so go ahead.
Yeah, a couple things. I did not respond to that caller's thing about marketing. So first, in 2015, with regard to the revenues, the women accrued $20 million in revenues, and the men lost $2.5 million that year on a $5 million revenue take. So it wasn't $4 million. It was a good $19 million more in revenues and $17 million in profit for the women that year. And secondly, it's interesting that the men now come forward and say they want to engage in a revenue sharing.
They might actually be at advantage now if they shared the revenue.
Well, yeah, because I can tell you this. During the women's fight a couple years ago negotiating the collective bargaining agreement, didn't hear one peep from the men at all about any of it, support or otherwise. And for them now to come indicate that they're willing to do a revenue share, it's because the women are making more money and accruing more revenues than the men, so they want to share in the spoils. And with regard to the marketing, that caller is absolutely correct. U.S. Soccer, they actually degrade their marketing prowess in the years after the women win World Cups and gold medals. And in fact, during the negotiations a couple of years, they referred to the 2 years after a World Cup victory as the marketing dark years, meaning they weren't going to spend much time or money marketing the women's team. So it's a very interesting set of dynamics that we expect to expose in the federal court soon.
Yeah. Well, Lindsay Gibbs, let's get back to what our caller was saying here, because I think she really sort of shines a light on the heart of the matter, that she's saying, actually, we're all kind of complicit in this because culturally we just value men's sports more than women's sports. And that is what we're seeing here, that even in a case where the women are by far more victorious in top soccer here than the men are, that we still have this lopsidedness because of basically who we decide to watch, who we think is more exciting.
Yeah, none of this is existing in a vacuum, right? You can't, which is why apples to apples comparisons are impossible, because that's not the world we live in. And I thought it was so interesting earlier when you had Brianna Scurry talking about how oftentimes these per diems or these travel accommodations, it was less for the sake of being less. And that's something I see throughout the women's sports I cover. You think back to Wimbledon in 2000, and I believe it was 2005, 2006, right before they went to equal prize money. What was the difference? $72,000 for the winner. That's less just for the sake of sending a message that this is lesser, right? There was no magical formula based on ticket sales and, TV ratings that made that exactly fair. It was less for the sake of being less. And I think that what's interesting is, our previous guest could see so clearly how on the grassroots level, the investment needs to be there at schools and everything on an equal level. But this is a chance for a top organization to set this example from the elite level, right? Mm. So why wouldn't you want that when the money is there?
Well, but let me ask you, though. I'm seeing here some numbers that were provided by the New York Times a couple of years ago. And there, if you're talking about elite, then there's also the elite amongst the elite. And they're saying that according to figures provided by U.S. Soccer, since 2008, it's played 12 players at least $1 million. And six of them were men and six of them were women. So maybe there are places where there's not an imbalance.
Well, if I could respond to that, I was involved with the creation of that story by Andy Doss at the New York Times. And the one thing that he did not include in the asterisk in that graph is that I think the numbers were the men over a 7-year period of time, the top men earned $1.4 million and the top women earned $1.2
million. Yeah.
Well, there should be an asterisk next to the women's number of $1.2 million because 75% of that $1.2 million were performance bonuses that the women earned as a result of winning the Olympic Games in 2008 and the World Cup runner-up in 2011 and the World Cup championship in 2015. So that's the reality. The women still earned 75% less than the men over that 7-year period of time. So to put those numbers together and put them out like U.S. Soccer always does without the asterisks indicating that 75% of that $1.2 million for the women was performance bonus, meaning they have to win, win, win at the top levels just to get paid close to what the men get paid for not winning anything and for just showing up.
But Rich, on the other hand, as you know, I mean, U.S. Soccer would say, well, the men, they don't get paid consistently. Like, they have to be picked for the team. And if they don't play in certain games, they don't get paid.
Yeah. So the men operate on a pay-to-play system, and that's the system that they elected to accede to in their collective bargaining agreement. Why? Because the men would rather not waste their time and play for the United States, because the more time they spend playing for the USA each year, the less time they get to play in their lucrative international soccer leagues. The women wanted the pay-to-play system always back in 2004 right up through 2015. But the U.S. soccer would not agree to guarantee that a certain number of games would be played so that the women could earn that money. So as a result, the default for the women is that they just had to take a salary in order to be guaranteed that they'd have any income at all for playing for the United States. So, you know, if U.S. soccer was willing to guarantee the women a certain number of games, the pay-to-play system would be great. And the women can't do the pay-to-play system now because we don't have a lucrative professional league to really go and make some money in.
Right.
So again, it's just not an equal argument. And until we get our arms around all the revenues that U.S. Soccer accrues from Soccer United Marketing, we're never going to know how much money the women are losing.
Lindsay, this is kind of a part of the conversation that's lurking here, that the men have the opportunity to play in places like the Premier League and make tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
Absolutely.
If they're good enough.
Yeah. And part of the reason for this salary is because the U.S. Soccer owns part of the National Women's Soccer League. And now we can debate all we want about whether or not U.S. Soccer is doing an adequate job promoting and funding the National Women's Soccer League. But they want the players, they want U.S. players to stay in this country and play on those teams. And part of that is giving them a salary.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to the callers. Bradley is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Bradley, you're on the air.
Hello. I've been a recreational tennis player for my whole life, and I'm proud that tennis has figured out how to pay the men and women equally. It started with the U.S. Open, I believe, in the 70s, with the United States Tennis Association leading the way by paying the men and the women champions the same amount. It took Wimbledon much longer to catch up with that. I think U.S. soccer has the same opportunity to lead the way. And my question is, how could soccer learn from what tennis has been able to achieve for a long time?
Right. Bradley, thank you so much for your call. Rich Nichols, you have a response to him?
I think if you peel back the onion on the tennis equal pay process, they get paid equally for the major tournaments. I think the tennis players that play all year round would beg to differ that they're being paid equally as the men are on the men's tour. And with regard to the U.S. soccer pay-to-play system for the men, I just want to make it clear to the listening public that in that pay-to-play system tier, the men get $17,625 per game if they win, $9,000 if they play to a tie, and $5,000 if they just show up for a game. And then the average money that a member of the women's team gets for playing in an average game is is $4,920. Wow. So no matter how you look at it, the women get paid less.
Lindsay Gibbs, you know, we've been talking about U.S. Soccer Federation here extensively, and obviously they have their perspective on this. But I want to just step back for a moment here and just take a look at how other federations, other sporting federations in the United States have dealt with this problem. I mean, interestingly, you know, for example, in figure skating, they balanced pay there between men and women, but it was to increase the pay of the men, right? To keep them in figure skating because the women are the stars there and the big revenue generators. So we've seen other federations tackle this head on. Why not in U.S. soccer?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good point that we have to remember. This is a national federation. Like, we're not talking about individual, you know, the Premier League or, you know, purely capitalistic. This is to play for the United States. So equality should, you know, a lot of organizations have already decided that equality should be part of that messaging. I know that the basketball, U.S. Basketball Association, they don't pay their players much salaries since that comes from their league play and otherwise. But all the travel accommodations and everything are the same. The women's basketball players are very happy with how the U.S. Basketball Association treats them.
Swimming also, right? I think swimming's done a good job at this.
Swimming also has done a really good job of this. But you look at other places where it's opposite, right? Where the men are the ones who are, you know, coming from the leagues with all the money and are making, you know, more money, such as hockey. And women have had to fight for every penny they've earned. We don't see women just being given equal treatment. It's all about the fight. Before 2017, the members of the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team were paid $6,000 every 4 years. That was a $1,000 training stipend for the 6 months leading up to an Olympics. And that was it. And they were expected to stay in shape all year round so they'd be available for tournaments when they came up. And now, after they threatened to boycott the World Championships in 2017, which was on U.S. soil, you know, they went from a boycott from top to bottom. Even high school players would not agree to cross the picket line and play for this World Championship. They actually got a much more fair deal. Now they're making, I think, about $72,000 of a base salary per year. But there's still a lot of work to do. They won the gold medal last year. There was no victory tour, you know, for the U.S. Women's National Hockey Team. So it's just an ongoing battle. And I think that's why it's so important what the women's soccer players are doing. They're saying, yes, we've achieved a lot, but there's a lot more to go. Oh, and plus, we deserve damages and back pay for the times when things were worse.
Rich Nichols, we've got just a minute left to go, under a minute, but go ahead and give us your last thought.
Yeah, there are a couple of things that I want to make clear also is that, you know, U.S. soccer is not hiding behind their belief that the women don't deserve to be paid equally. In fact, in the lawsuit filed by the team on Friday, there was a high-level executive from U.S. soccer during the negotiations a couple of years ago who said the following, quote, "market realities are such that the women do not deserve to be paid equally to the men," unquote. And then another high-level executive during these same negotiations said, quote, "the level of competition of the women's game is not the same as the men, so the women do not deserve to be paid the same as the men." That's from U.S. soccer. So that's their position, and they're going to have to defend that position in federal court.
Right, and in federal court, and also perhaps in the court of public opinion, as we have the Women's World Cup coming up this summer.
Yes.
And the U.S., as we keep saying, is ranked number one, multiple World Cup champions. So we'll see what happens. Rich Nichols, sports industry lawyer and currently representing Hope Solo in her lawsuit against U.S. soccer. Thank you so much for joining us, Rich.
Thank you very much.
And Lindsay Gibbs, sports reporter at Think Progress and co-host of the sports podcast Burn It All Down. We've got links to her reporting at onpointradio.org. Lindsay, it's been terrific to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.